A jail stint can really disrupt someone's life. You can lose a job, a relationship, or thousands of dollars on fees, fines, and bail.
Have I ever gone to jail? Yeah, I just got out, actually.
If he doesn't show up to court, you gotta pay the $50,000.
No ring exchange, no kiss the bride. There's no glamour in a jailhouse wedding.
Off the Block. All six episodes tracing the path from city block to jail block and back are now available on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
It was very, very intense, and we spent kind of 2.5 weeks, you know, siding with the outlaws. And the quickness, the pace we were doing it felt like we were being a bit outlawish in our methodology as well.
Hell or High Water director David McKenzie had to shoot a bunch of bank robberies fast before one of his stars, Chris Pine, went off to film another movie. McKenzie tells us how his stripped-down approach to directing was essential to making one of the best-reviewed movies of the year. But first on the news banter, Warner's hopes Fantastic Beasts will generate fantastic box office returns. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my associate in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So we don't know as we are recording how big the opening of Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, which is the spinoff of the Harry Potter world created by J.K. Rowling. We don't know how big it will be at the box office this weekend as we're talking, but we do know it isn't going to be small. This is something that Warner Brothers really is counting on. They have dated five of these films. So obviously the confidence was very high. You know, it's not the same Daniel Radcliffe and the original crew, but it is the original producer and the director, David Yates, who has made several Harry Potter films. So, you know, unlike DC Comics, where Warner's has had, you know, success, but not huge success, it seems like the chances that fans will embrace Fantastic Beasts are pretty good.
Right. And I think that's due to one significant X factor, and that's J.K. Rowling herself, the author of the books. This is her first screenplay. She wrote it for Fantastic Beasts. It's being released as a book simultaneously with the film. And arguably, that is the biggest star associated with the Harry Potter universe, is this wildly creative author who created it all. And I think that has allowed Warner Brothers to be confident in the success of the franchise so that they were able to announce these five films. Unlike with the DC universe, where they need to kind of figure out the creative team each time, and the studio doesn't have an overarching creative force in the DC universe like Marvel does with Kevin Feige, who oversees all the Marvel films. They're trying. They brought in Geoff Johns, who's a big comic book person, and they have a couple of other people in the DC world that are now plotting out these films over years and years. But I think the Harry Potter world is a much safer bet once they establish this as the new franchise, which I think they've done.
I think it'll be a big relief to them, assuming it works. And, you know, we should say that Batman versus Superman and Suicide Squad, it's not like they didn't do business. They did. They just didn't do the kind of business that would be expected, particularly Batman versus Superman, two iconic characters. You would think that you get to $1 billion worldwide in box office on that movie. And they're very expensive, and they did a number, but that it was nothing like the kind of uncork the champagne bottles that they were anticipating.
Well, and also, you know, if you ask Warner's about this, they point to their earnings, which are up, and Suicide Squad actually outperformed what a lot of people thought it would do at the box office. But if you look at the general fan response to these films, the media and the reviews and the response has not been as high as the Marvel movies get. And, you know, that's a high bar because most of these Marvel movies actually are well-reviewed in addition to do well at the box office. But I think Warner's would like to up the creative execution on some of these DC films.
Yeah, we're seeing this now with Marvel. It has Doctor Strange in theaters. And, you know, it's not like Doctor Strange was some universally known character. You know, Marvel has been able to take things that are obscure relatively and make them into gigantic successes. And I will say also, we had a very exuberant box office weekend. The weekend before, we saw Doctor Strange do well, Trolls hold well, Mel Gibson's Hacksaw Ridge holding well, Arrival coming into theaters strongly, almost Christmas. There was a speculation that maybe in the wake of the election, people just wanted to go to the movies.
I totally agree. I believe the election fatigue that people had, whether you were a Trump supporter or not, and especially people who were not, were looking for some escapism at the theaters. And, you know, Arrival did almost 35% more, I think, if my math is correct, than the initial tracking. And the overall weekend was up 45% over last year. Now, Veterans Day also was on a Friday this year, so that's something to consider. But I think people are ready to go to movies if the right kind of movies are in theaters, and these fantasy, big fantasy movies are probably the right kind.
Absolutely. So I'm going to turn to the world of television, where certain people are also making incredible amounts of money. This is partly or largely a function of Amazon and Netflix coming into the space and getting huge stars like Robert De Niro or Meryl Streep to do TV series. We're talking about, for De Niro, he is getting $750,000 for each of 20 episodes of an upcoming Amazon series. This is produced by David O. Russell, and he is supposedly working on a budget of $7 million per episode for this series. I will say I have recently been watching The Crown on Netflix, and I just tweeted recently, you know, I'm enjoying the series, but I'm pretty sure I could live comfortably for the rest of my life on the cost of one episode of The Crown. It just looks sumptuous.
The live animal budget on some of these episodes is probably more than your average cable drama.
Yeah, so these people are doing very well. I mean, still the biggest stars on network TV do the best. You know, these guys who have been on The Big Bang Theory, for example, they make $1 million an episode. But for Amazon and Netflix, they're changing the way business is done in this town with these kinds of offers.
Right. I mean, stars of established shows getting big paydays is not a new thing. I mean, The Big Bang stars, they've been on that show forever. But what is new is the skyrocketing salaries for people to do television in the first place. Getting people on those first year shows or limited series or movies on TV, they're getting a caliber of actor that was not previously doing television, and they're paying for it. And I think there's a couple of reasons why. One, these limited series now allow actors to kind of treat them as an extended film. So Meryl Streep, who is being paid more than $800,000 per episode for this miniseries, The Knicks, that's a limited series. She doesn't have to commit to a show. She will treat it like an extended film. She'll do it and it'll be over. And she'll make what she would make on a film. It's just doing it for television. And that, I think, is the new model for these film actors as the great roles disappear in films, replaced by the comic books and Star Wars, etc. They're looking to television, and they're being paid for this because there are so many outlets now that are trying to establish themselves as go-to places for original high-end content. Amazon and Netflix are paying outrageous sums. The other networks, if they want these talents, they have to keep up.
I will say, and the point that Ted Sarandos made recently at a Hollywood Reporter roundtable, they don't do back ends or syndication. You don't get that revenue when you star in a Netflix show. And the Netflix model is, you know, we're not going to even tell you who's watching it, but you are going to get a big payday up front. So that partially explains how the model is different and why this big expenditure is possible, or I don't even know how long it can be sustained, but it for now is possible in that world.
Yeah, and the trickle-down effect is what we're seeing elsewhere. I mean, if you look at someone like Kiefer Sutherland, who we believe is making about $300,000 per episode for Designated Survivor to star and executive produce. That's the most ever for a first-year actor on a show. That's an extraordinary price, and that's someone who is courted by many, many different outlets.
The rich get richer, Matt. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter. The film Hell or High Water follows a pair of brothers who turn to bank robbery in drought-stricken, post-recession West Texas, and the two lawmen who try to hunt them down. Brothers Toby and Tanner Howard are played by Chris Pine and Ben Foster. Toby has been struggling to run the family ranch while Tanner was serving time in prison. Following Tanner's release, the normally law-abiding Toby recruits him in a desperate attempt to rob banks. After an early success, Tanner is ready to go again.
Maybe we should hit another branch.
You know, you talk like we ain't gonna get away with this.
I've never met nobody got away with anything, ever. You.
And why in the hell did you agree to do it?
because you asked, little brother.
The two Texas Rangers pursuing the robbers are played by Jeff Bridges and Gil Birmingham. Bridges' character, facing retirement, is happy to have one more case to solve.
It's reckless is what it is. Oh. It's tweakers, I'm telling you.
I don't think these boys is reckless. Damn sure it's tweakers. They know exactly what they're doing.
I don't know how you're going to survive without somebody to outsmart.
Maybe one of these bank robbers is going to want a gunfight, and I can dodge my retirement in a blaze of glory.
Well, I've seen you shoot. Won't be much glory in it.
Our guest today is Hell or High Water director David McKenzie, who before this movie was best known for making independent films in Great Britain. McKenzie is Scottish, but he was instantly drawn to the Texas tale written by actor and screenwriter Taylor Sheridan. Of course, neither Sheridan nor McKenzie had an inkling of the outcome of this year's presidential race when they worked on the film, but when we talked to McKenzie just after the election, the movie's themes of economic desperation, hopelessness, and anger felt especially relevant.
Yeah, we shot the movie a year and a half ago, at which time Mr. Trump wasn't in the limelight at all in the way he became. We had no kind of idea that what's happened in this country was going to happen, you know, but it seems kind of interesting that the film was swimming in the waters of the themes that were part of that force or whatever you want to call it. And it makes me think in a way that the film was observing the right thing, you know, and although I have to say it was sort of coincidental and not intentional.
A little bit by accident. Seems of a piece with Brexit, right?
I think it is. People are imagining that the political infrastructure can be dismantled and somehow or other improved in some way which no one actually really knows how, but it's a sort of desperation that makes a certain portion of the electorate kind of go, well, ripping it up and start again, even though it's chaos, is a preferable thing to the status quo, which is, it's strange times, I think. But our film kind of taps into that sense of dispossession that kind of came about from the recession or whatever you call the crash of 2008, and traveling through Texas and New Mexico, you still feel that. You can still feel all those for sale signs there. You have a sense that that landscape never really recovered.
The film was on the blacklist. The script was on the blacklist, I should say.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of any of that. And I just read it and really liked it and thought I could do something with it. And it spoke to me in a really good way because it had character, had great sense of place. It had a really lovely narrative arc, and I immediately fell in love with it. And very rapidly, you know, we got to make it. So I wasn't aware of any of the sort of prehistory of it.
How did the film come to you?
It was given to me by my agent, and I liked it, and we campaigned to kind of get it, and that was that. You know, it was very sort of straightforward process, really.
What was it in your work, you think, that made them say, this is the guy to do a film set in the American West?
I don't know. I'd made a movie called Startup, which people were liking a lot. They liked it for its sense of authenticity, for the intensity, for the sort of sensitivity, I guess, of the masculine kind of exploration. And I can't speak exactly for what they were thinking, but that's the impression I got.
And so you get the script. There's not a little voice in your head saying, hey, I'm Scottish, what do I know?
No. I read the script and I go, this is like those great 70s American movies that I grew up on and that I love. And there's a lovely sense of connection to great American cinema in that material. And so my personal nationality wasn't really relevant to that. And I'd also spent some time in West Texas anyway, which chimed with that too.
How did you spend time in West Texas?
I just had a friend who lived in Alpine, Texas, and I went and stayed with him for a while. And was sort of struck, that's where they shot Giant. And, you know, it struck by that landscape and just thought I wanted to do a movie in that space. And then when this thing came along, it made sense, you know.
Obviously, people think of this as a Western in the modern era.
It's funny. People are very comfortable with calling it a Western. I'm less comfortable with calling it. I mean, I think it's a mixture of genres. And
it's not a classic Western in the true sense, I guess, although it sort of is.
I think some people think it is. You know, I think of it as much a buddy movie and a road movie and a family drama, and also, you know, a snapshot of some of the fault lines of contemporary America, which is what I kind of love about it. Is on the surface, it feels like a kind of entertaining kind of crime genre movie, and then underneath it all, it's a film that's really about something and about many of the frayed nerves of this country now. So I guess my last film, I sort of smuggled in a family drama into a quite intense family drama into a prison genre movie. And in a way, it's sort of a similar tactic to smuggle in a sort of some quite profound social commentary into something that appears to be cops and robbers. You know?
Yes, indeed. So who came first? You've got Chris Pine and Jeff Bridges.
Yeah, the film came together very quickly, so they all came together. Chris, Ben, and Jeff were all sort of on it within 2 or 3 weeks of each other. So
that was a really fast.
Yeah, it came. I mean, I had something like 5.5 weeks prep, or maybe even less. And you know, I shot Chris for 2.5 weeks because of his schedule. And it all kind of coagulated very quickly.
I read that you shot a lot in sequence.
I shot the Chris and Ben stuff in sequence. Yeah, I love shooting in sequence because as a director, you don't have to think about the jigsaw puzzle. You just
follow the character now.
You follow the experience of it, and it's great for actors as well. It was very, very intense, and we spent kind of 2.5 weeks siding with the outlaws. And the pace we were doing it felt like we were being a bit outlawish in our methodology as well. And I like to have a very kind of free set. I keep as much of the kind of stuff that gets in the way out of it, the impediments to filmmaking. I don't use clapperboards or have continuity or have monitors, or you know, I just have a little tiny monitor just for me, and I just try and keep as much focus on being able to just keep extracting the juice from the scene with the kind of creative core. And that's a method that's quite well suited to being quite quick, so it all sort of helped. And then when Chris left and the schedule became like a normal schedule, and it was kind of, you know, we slowed down a bit, we had 5-day weeks, and we had Jeff and Gil, and it was a, you know, and siding with the lawmen, and it was a totally different kind of pace and energy. But both groups were like family, you know, and we socialized together at the weekend, and, you know, and Jeff and Gil would play their guitars, and it was just kind of really lovely. It was just a very strong experience for all of us.
That's a very stripped down approach to making a movie. I mean, if you have no script supervisors, etc., you're making a face like, ooh, those people, but how do you keep it in your head? How do you know you've got the continuity?
Well, I don't care about continuity. You know, continuity is a meaningless construct because you're trying to match and something that's never going to be matched in the same way. It's a complete waste of time. And very rarely now we've got nonlinear editing, do editors ever look at continuity notes? And we did have a continuity person, but the poor guy was stuck in the edit room just providing the studio with strange progress reports, which also feel very redundant to me. But it's just like, it's old cinema, and you know, you don't have to do that anymore. So why impede yourself with a process which has no real value? And for me, it's just about not letting the process control you, and you control the process. And the filmmaking is reflective of what the needs of the film is, rather than what the orthodoxies of filmmaking are.
So how much was improvised of the dialogue?
I always do quite a lot of improvising around the material. I always, you know, deeply respect the script. You know, we're trying to kind of capture the essence of that, but also be liberated from it. And so most scenes we improvise, we mess around. And there was quite a lot of stuff that Jeff and Gil did in the car that was just pure improv. We just gave them some subjects to talk about that I didn't feel we'd quite kind of captured, and they just riffed away. And they were so good at it because they'd play music together. Their sort of skills at kind of reading each other and bouncing off each other were excellent. And Jeff in particular is a great improviser.
He's in that character, and he can play that character and improvise that character.
He's an amazing actor in terms of he is totally on it. You don't think of him as being somebody who is that focused on it, but he researched the Rangers character, spent 2 or 3 days with these guys, and I thought, okay, Jeff's going to be relying on these guys, you know.
Real Rangers?
Yeah, mm-hmm. But I never like it when actors are relying on other people apart from me. But then eventually he kind of, you know, let go of those umbilicals and just, you know, he'd had enough of the character, that input from it, and then just found it in his own way and just kind of just was, you know. And
he constructed it for himself, yeah.
Yeah.
Even you were surprised.
I was certainly surprised and happy.
I just will mention, you shot in New Mexico for Texas because of tax incentives.
That's true, yes. It's unfortunate. We wanted to shoot in Texas, but we'd lose a week of shooting for doing so because of the budget. And we then came to the conclusion that the difference between the two places was marginal enough for us to shoot in New Mexico close to the border and have the advantage of the tax incentives, which would get us at least, I think it was even like 10 extra days of shooting or something like that. It would make a difference from
wow,
a scary
much.
Schedule to a not-so-scary schedule. So we took the decision reluctantly not to do that and made every effort we possibly could to make it as close to Texas in flavor and tone, and obviously cast Texans and do as much as we could to kind of pull the Texas back into the film.
Coming up after a short break, director David McKenzie never wants to make a comic book movie. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. And one way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. You can put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off, too. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to director David McKenzie about Hell or High Water, a modern Western heist film buddy movie that follows two Texas Rangers pursuing a pair of bank-robbing brothers. As they close in on their quarry, the Rangers, played by Jeff Bridges and Gil Birmingham, keep up their teasing patter.
This is what they call white man's intuition.
Sometimes a blind pig finds a truffle.
Hell or High Water premiered at Cannes, opened in theaters over the summer, and is now an awards contender. I read that you did tests with American audiences, which is not something I imagine you've done previously with movies.
No, I haven't done any testing before, and I have to say I found it uncomfortable to begin with. I really liked sitting with my editor and feeling the audience all the way through, and that informed us almost more than anything else. And reading some of the reports, I found the kind of focus groups pretty scary, and I couldn't help feeling that the guy who was running the focus group was asking leading questions, and I felt that was somehow unfair.
Like, how much did you dislike?
Well, just sort of, they were pushing certain things, pushing certain agendas, and I don't know whether they were doing that off their own bat or whether there were other voices in the room, you know, but we were never dictated to by it anyway, but... Yeah, I found them less useful, but I definitely found, and I've talked with other directors about it, that the feeling of the room is really important. So you don't go and put your film in front of an audience in Cannes without having a sense of what an audience can do, even though they're not the same thing. And each time we tested, I mean, I cut in 4 weeks, and it was like, that was it. You know, and I edit as I go along, and I show, you know, the cut of the film at the wrap party, which I did it for Hell or High Water too. So the film was very well formed immediately after we shot. And I had 3 months of editing in Scotland, and it was even more well formed. And then we did another 3 to 4 months of editing and testing in LA. And my editor and I, Jake Roll, very talented guy, we kept on surprising ourselves. Well, we can still take more out, and we can still take more out, and we can still take more out. And just
whittling it down,
mm-hmm. It was really interesting because we're tough. We slash stuff if it's not working, you know. But we kept on surprising ourselves by more and more stuff that could go. And I do think it was right. I think in the end, there were some various kind of things that were impeding the flow of it that we just got to know eventually by going through that process that we wouldn't have done. We would have sat with what we'd got if we hadn't sort of felt that awkwardness, you know, and I think the film's better for it.
So whose idea was Cannes?
I was keen on Cannes. I had a film called Young Adam about 12 years ago in Cannes. You know. Cannes is terrifying because it's very exposed, and if people don't like it, they don't like it very publicly.
Loudly.
And loudly. And it's changed from when I was there 12 years ago in that now everyone's on Twitter, and so you get the kind of reaction in real time, you know. And we were in the middle of doing our press thing, and there was a press screening of the film, and it was coming out like in real time, like, this is great, this is really good, this is, you know. And it's like, gosh, phew, you know, you're getting that sense of relief that it's going your way, you know. But for 2 hours, you have no idea what it's going to do. It's scary, but in our case, I think it worked for us, and it was a good entry into the world for the film.
So the release date was end of summer, which is sometimes considered, honestly, a dumping ground for movies.
Yeah, I was very nervous about that, but it proved to be a good move, I think.
Shrewd.
Yeah. It's a much more crowded marketplace around this time of year. You know, the film was allowed to kind of have a proper life in the theatres and did pretty well. So
I had read where someone asked you if you would then, with this kind of a American noisy success, relatively noisy really, segue to a Marvel film, and you had a few choice words about that. You were not interested in that.
I don't really connect to comics, I'm afraid. I read them when I was a kid, you know, but as an adult, it's sort of not for me, you know. And I know that lots of people do and all that, but I'm more interested in stories about human beings and real things. You know, there's too much energy to make a film to work on something that you can't really connect with, so I'm looking for projects that feel like they have a heart and soul and are about something and not just in a metaphorical way, which is what these things... I mean, that's always the excuse for these things, is they're actually metaphors for something else, but I don't think people read them that much as that, and I don't really
care. You don't think Captain America is a big metaphor for something? Yeah, I mean, they eat the studio's release schedules.
Well, they're very popular, aren't they? But the films that I like are the... You know, as I've mentioned, those lovely films from the 70s, it's a humanist kind of... soulful realist dramas, you know, that got sort of destroyed when event cinema kind of obliterated everything else around it, you know. So I'm not sort of predisposed towards any of that kind of spectacle stuff, really.
But you feel like you can, I mean, you're working and busy and made 9 films in 14 years. That's a lot, right?
Yeah, I'm, nearly unemployed again. I have to kind of find another job. You know.
You did one other movie in the U.S., right? Spread, with Ashton Kutcher. Who were the producers?
It was Ashton's company called Catalyst, I think.
Catalyst. So yeah. Ashton Kutcher's company produced Spread.
I had a really good time making it. And actually had a, you know, worked well with him, and Anne Hesh was fantastic, and it was fantastic to make a movie in the sort of about Hollywood, in Hollywood, in, you know, in the heart of the beast. For me, coming from Scotland, that was kind of interesting. Towards the end of post-production, there was a little bit of intervention that put me off it, and there was some attitude from one or two people that I didn't like, and it didn't end well, but most of it was good.
I mean, if I'm reading between the lines, it sounds like you're talking about the cut of the film.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, there are probably only four or five things that aren't mine in there, and they didn't really make that much difference to the film. So I can shrug my shoulders on that. Just one or two kind of not particularly nice kind of personal elements at the end that left a nasty taste in my mouth. But no disrespect to anyone, and naming no names, and da da da, you know.
Da-da-da-da.
The beat and gone, you know.
And you came back here. Did you have trepidation about being back with an American sensibility about how people behave?
Yes, but Rich Kluber, my agent, was very encouraging about the kind of people I was working with, and you know, different sorts of people with a lot more experience in making movies, and so it wasn't too trepidatious.
So now you're, I don't know, do you feel like, well, I think I'll go back to Scotland and make a movie? Or are you thinking, here I am in the States?
I was going to move, but then I went back to my family in Scotland, and we had a mutiny. You know, they didn't want to be uprooted from their nice life there and their friends and family and all that. So and I do have a couple of Scottish projects, one of which is on quite a big scale and is potentially a studio movie. So I could get the best of both worlds by being able to kind of work within the studio and do a Scottish film. So, but I'm also looking at various other things. So we'll see what happens. Yeah.
So next you're doing, you actually, I thought you were doing a pilot, a TV pilot.
I've just done it already,
for USA.
Yeah.
Damnation.
Yeah.
And have you done television?
I've never done television before, even in the UK. So it was an interesting experience, but it was actually, I mean, I had Giles who shot six of my movies on it. I had a first AD who I've worked with before. I had Gillian, my producing partner. I had Nicole, who's done makeup on three of my movies.
You kept it in the family.
We had a little Scottish family out there in Calgary where we were shooting, and so it just felt rather like making a film, to be honest. It didn't feel very different, and we shot it in CinemaScope, and we're trying to work out whether the studio will allow us to put out. You know, it's not much TV gets put out with the letterboxing, but the frames are much nicer, so I hope they do.
Oh, it's not decided yet.
It's a movie
on TV.
Well, kind of, yeah. I mean, and it's a very interesting subject matter. It's about striking farmers in 1930s Iowa being subjected to dirty tricks by Pinkerton strike breakers, and it's got a strong, rich political theme to it, and it's really interesting.
You're sort of turning into the Scottish version of John Steinbeck. The whole American experience of the dispossessed.
Well, I don't know if there are worse people to be following footsteps of. You know.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I read somewhere where you said that you thought a lot of people who ended up in the Texas setting that was the setting for Hell or High Water were Scottish settlers.
I think there are a lot of Scots there, yeah. And I think that there's something about the Texan toughness, but underneath the toughness, generosity and often kindness that's very similar to the way that the Scots are. So, you can feel that there's a resonance there.
David McKenzie is the director of Hell or High Water. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.